Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And we are still in the throes of the North Carolina debates. And folks, I can't tell you, it ain't going to change. It is now or never. And bottom line, if you want to be, well, let me just say this, you know, that 90-second elevator speech, that we have a self-governing system, that government is basically the ultimate check on our government is we the people. And there is a constitutional process that has been given to us to actually contain our government or basically attack it constitutionally when they start stepping out of line. We hear this regarding the oath, and we just ended the show on this one particular point yesterday. So we're going to kind of pick back up. We got Paul here with us, but bottom line, the blood is on your hands. It is on the hands of the people of America for not holding the government in check. We all know the framers knew that whenever there was power given, that, you know, the desire to increase that power outside the bounds of the power given is just, it's imminent. Almost every time, there's not a person. Well, I shouldn't say there's not a person, but there's too few people that have been given power that have actually lived within those constraints. They tend to, oddly enough, they tend to gravitate towards exercising this unauthorized dominion over things that aren't within their authority. So, Paul, welcome back. And we kind of ended up, you know, yesterday, you know, we're get cut off again because, you know, we run out of time, and I'm enjoying these conversations. And as I'm kind of reading and focusing, I don't see the little recording device. It'd be great to have an engineer, but anywho, because that's what an engineer would do. But anywho, any other points on what we read already in the yesterday's last comments and so forth?
Not so far. I should point out that you know, these are deep thinkers and engaged speakers, and so it takes a little while. Like I mentioned earlier, like I mentioned yesterday, I'll be reading these more, because like the scriptures, I guess the more you read it, the more you'll understand it. Some of these things may be going by me. And I guess I recommend this to your listeners as well. Did I ask maybe last week sometime or the week before if what you've got here is available to them?
Yeah, so I actually updated everything this past weekend, so we don't have this week's content, what we're doing today, but everything that was done last week. And as a matter of fact, I didn't even tell everybody that the petition for the Department of Education, you know, and how it is a violation of the Constitution itself, that petition is up on the website now. So, folks, you're more than welcome to look at that petition and, you know, pull it down. And, you know, please let us know. We'll be happy to help you so that that can get converted and help you prepare to, you know, get signatures and move forward in petitioning your government for the redress of grievances, and have, you know, hold our public servants accountable for why are you dealing with an unconstitutional agency, and why are you allowing the federal government to operate these types of agencies without authority?
Right.
Right.
Okay. And just as a follow-up, are the ratification debates available to the listeners?
Yes.
What we're reading?
All up to New York. So New York is up there, I believe. Let me confirm this. Because I make the presumption that they are, and so, but sometimes they're not. And so if you go to Red State Talk Radio podcast page and you look at all of the different debates, the Virginia, okay, so I haven't put up the New York debates yet. So everything but the New York debates are up. And so I'll get those up this week, and I will put up the North Carolina debates when we're done. So,
okay.
Okay.
Are they available in print?
I'm sorry, what? Yeah. So that I put the documents, and they're not only in print, they're the print that you and I are using with the highlights, with the, right. you know, the navigation pane having the, you know, indentations or what have you. So they can literally go to the next, to the next, to the next, and, you know, actually read along with us or with you.
All right.
Okay.
All right. So when we read yesterday, I think this is one of the times we did not get cut off in the middle of a paragraph.
That is correct.
So if I'm not mistaken, Bill of Rights enumerating powers. Is that right?
That is correct. It's still Mr. Spate. And yeah, this is the Bill of Rights and the enumerate. Mr. McLean, I'm sorry. The Bill of Rights and the enumerating powers. Yep.
Okay. The gentleman has wandered out of his way to tell us what has so often been said out of doors, that there is no Declaration of Rights, that consequently all our rights are taken away. It would be very extraordinary to have a Bill of Rights because the powers of Congress are expressly defined, and the very definition of them is as valid and efficacious a check as a Bill of Rights could be without the dangerous implication of a Bill of Rights. The powers of Congress are limited and enumerated. We say we have given them these powers, but we do not say we have given them more. We retain all those rights which we have not given away to the general government. The gentleman is a professional man. If a gentleman had made his last will and testament and devised and bequeathed to a particular person the sixth part of his property or any particular specific legacy, could it be said that the person should have the whole estate? If they can assume powers not enumerated, there was no occasion for enumerating any powers. The gentleman is learned. Without recurring to his learning, he may only appeal to his common sense. It will inform him that if we had all power before and gave away but a part, we still retain the rest. It is as plain a thing as possibly can be that Congress can have no power but what we expressly give them. There is an express clause which, however disingenuously it has been perverted from its true meaning, clearly demonstrates that they are confined to those powers which are given them. This clause enables them to, quote, make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or any department or officers thereof, end quote. This clause specifies that they shall make laws to carry into execution all the powers vested by this Constitution. Consequently, they can make no laws to execute any other power. This clause gives no new power, but declares that those already given are to be executed by proper laws. I hope this will satisfy gentlemen.
Well, I'll bet you it doesn't.
Yeah. Would you say, I'll bet it doesn't?
I'll bet it doesn't. Yeah, because, you know, it wasn't really about the, you know, the limitations and the Bill of Rights. It was really about not ratifying. Which is why, regardless of what these people said, they, you know, they were stuck in the paradigm that you had to have this. And because I demand that you have to have this, we cannot ratify this. Because that created literally a black and white issue, you know, or on or off. It made the issue binary, when actually it really wasn't binary, nor was it necessarily, you know, their perspective, because as he said here, he actually talks about it, that it was perverted. It's a perverted concept. You know, can you in your estate, you know, give 1/6 of your estate to somebody and they can presume that they can take the whole estate?
Of course not. It's to presume otherwise would be nonsensical.
Right. So that's the whole point. And regardless of how well these guys were shut down, they didn't surrender. They held the line. You know, it's just like the progressives holding the line that we have to end, you know, prayer in school. We have to end prayer in school. And, you know, they keep on doing this to a point where they make compromise on, you know, on things that actually aren't even compromisable. Like they'll hold up on a legitimate budget, and then they'll get, you know, the brethren to say, okay, we're not going to pass this budget unless you surrender and do something you shouldn't do. And allow us right. to end prayer in school. This is how evil works.
Right.
When it's not okay. up for debate. Anyway,
this Bill of Rights was a hot issue.
Oh yeah, apparently. These debates, the North Carolina debates, deals with it the most.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. And so at some point, not right now, but at some point, we probably ought to have the discussion of what might it have looked like without a Bill of Rights. But I think that would be going down a rabbit hole that we may not have time to do right now.
No, not necessarily, but that's okay. That's okay. Let's just go ahead and dive into what Mr. Johnston, Governor Johnston, actually says. Because so here's an interesting thing. Do you think mm-hmm. the governor of North Carolina was pro-Constitution or pro, you know, not having this new government?
Well, I would guess. Now, this is the government of North Carolina. This is one of the three. Well, let's see. Was it the Carolinas and Georgias? This is one of the three states promoting slavery,
uh-huh.
right?
Yep.
So I'm guessing that he maybe you don't have him here as an anti-federalist.
I don't. So it kind of it lays that, you know, it lays that out there. So now you have that insight, and you can actually say, you can easily deduct what the true answer is. He was a federalist.
Right.
He was a federalist. Where Clinton was not. Clinton was an anti-federalist. And Henry, another former governor, we actually had a couple of active governors during the ratification debate say, I think this is a better system.
Okay.
In other words, they weren't a part of that cabal.
Right. Okay. Governor Johnston was probably one of these, was probably a federalist. Right?
Yeah, he was. Well, he was. Yes, he was.
Right?
Yep.
All right. Jurisdiction Bill of Rights is the title, Governor Johnston. Mr. Chairman, the learned member from Anson says that the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction of all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution and laws of the United States. The opinion which I have always entertained is that they will, in these cases, as well as in several others, have concurrent jurisdiction with the state courts and not exclusive jurisdiction. I see nothing in this Constitution which hinders a man from bringing suit wherever he thinks he can have justice done him. The jurisdiction of these courts is established for some purposes with which the state courts have nothing to do, and the Constitution takes no power from the state courts, which they now have.
Let me interject.
They will have the same.
Let me interject.
Yeah.
See, mm-hmm. there's a paradigm that we just kind of glossed over that is completely lost today, and it's called justice. Now, as he just said, I see nothing in this Constitution which hinders a man from bringing suit wherever he thinks he can have justice done him. Not in today's paradigm of favor for him, because many times people look at the legal system as an opportunity to gain favor, like suing McDonald's for millions of dollars.
Right.
And they pursue that in a court that can gain favor for them where they can have a monetary outcome. In other words, our justice right. system has been moved from a true, pure system of justice to a system of social justice. Don't tell me that the old lady from Arizona, wherever she was, that had hot coffee spill in her lap, didn't receive social justice with that outrageous award.
Right.
That wasn't justice. And any person truly with morals would have said, you know what? I don't care what these people say. I don't deserve that type of financial reward.
Right.
This is how everybody has been corrupted. And it's money.
Wait.
Money corrupts everybody.
By the way, who spilled the coffee? Did she spill it on herself? Or
yeah,
did they,
she put it in her lap. She went through the drive-thru, and she put it in her lap, and as she negotiated her car, the top came off and got into her lap, and she burnt her lap. And she suffered, you know, the second degree. Obviously, it wouldn't have been third degree, not with boiling water, at least with clothes and boiling water. I don't think she suffered a third degree burn. What with the magnitude of the pain and everything else, it couldn't have been the millions of dollars. I mean, whatever she sat, I mean, it's not like this disabled her of her life. You know, she may have not been able to work for a couple of days. So what would the compensation have been for the medical expenses and a few days of labor or a week of labor? Because she couldn't walk or what have you. See my point?
Yeah, but dumb question, okay? She's an adult. She knows her coffee's hot. She puts it in an unstable position. Was it McDonald's fault?
Well, so she's not only an adult, she's a mature adult. If you look at the lady's age, I think she was more of a grandma.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So she should have been wiser, right? I could see a kid, you know, first time driving and having hot coffee in a car, not thinking. And boy, oh, well, shoot, I learned my lesson. But somebody of her age that had been driving as long, she should have been, you know, smarter not to put herself in that kind of position. And so, you know, how is she not at fault? You're absolutely right. How is this even justice?
Right.
So my point is that when he was saying seeking justice, these were honorable men that actually was seeking the not the outcome that benefited them, but truly justice.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. I didn't leave.
So go ahead
there,
and pick
though.
Back up with the jurisdiction of these courts.
Okay. The jurisdiction of these courts is established for some purposes with which the state courts have nothing to do, and the Constitution takes no power from the state courts, which they now have. They will have the same business which they have now, and if so, they will have enough to employ their time. We know that the gentlemen who preside in our superior courts have more business than they can determine. Their complicated jurisdiction and the great extent of the country occasions them a vast deal of business. The addition of the business of the United States would be no manner of advantage to them. It is obvious to everyone that there ought to be one Supreme Court for national purposes, but the gentleman says that a Bill of Rights was necessary. It appears to me, sir, that it would have been the highest absurdity to undertake to define what rights the people of the United States were entitled to. For that would be as much as to say they were entitled to nothing else. Bill of Rights may be necessary in a monarchical government whose powers are undefined. Were we in the situation of a monarchical country? No, sir. Every right could not be enumerated, and the omitted rights would be sacrificed if security arose from an enumeration. The Congress cannot assume any other powers than those expressly given them without a palpable violation of the Constitution.
Okay, so that's really, really bold and red right there, right? I mean, that's an emphatic statement. That is an absolute. Congress cannot assume any other power than those expressly given them without a palpable violation of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So healthcare, energy, education, labor, housing, I could just go on and on for days because literally I got a spreadsheet that has well over 600 different types of offices and agencies.
You know, you and I did that independently because I did that a few months ago and I was stunned, and it wasn't that hard to find.
No, it's not.
All right. But you're right. Over 600 independent agencies that are not defined in the Constitution.
And to be honest with you, I have not done it since the 2010s, like 2013 maybe was the last time I did it. If I did it today, we would have Space Force and all of the sub-elements of that, as well as some of this crap that O'Biden has done. Or not O'Biden. That would probably be more correctly, right? O'Biden? Sometimes, folks, sometimes my mouth works much faster than my head. or actually my head is, you know, my mouth is just trying to catch up truly with what I'm thinking. And I, as I'm thinking something, my mouth kind of just puts it all together. Anyway, forgive me.
I did this. You know what, Jer, I did this in... I did this in... Oh, no, that's yours.
Oh, okay.
When did I do that? Earlier this year, I think February. Yes. Let me see. Just for the heck of it, let me see what I found. I had...
Now, what was your source for this information, by the way? Because you can, there's two different sources out there that one can use as a reference point. It sounds like we've kind of lost Paul, and it sounds like Paul's finally back. But, Paul, what was your source? Was it Wikipedia, or did you go to government and the government accounting office to identify all of the entities?
I think I may have gone to the GIO, because I wanted the government's word on this. I came out with 629 federal things.
Right.
Some of them, the Department of State's probably a legitimate one, but I wanted all of them.
Right, but they're if you look subordinate to the Department of State are things that they've assumed that are unconstitutional. Just like the Department of Treasury, you know, just like the Department of War. As we kind of look at, you know, each of the different bodies, you know, the large bodies of departments, the departments create subordinate bodies that actually are not within their power. Well, it seems like we're having a problem with Paul. So bottom line, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and try to finish reading this. And then we'll work out our connection during the break, and that way we can come back and take off the rest of this. And so moving on, this is what Governor Johnson said. Such objections as this, I hope, will have no effect on the minds of any members in this House. When gentlemen object generally that it tends to consolidate the states and destroy their state jurisdictions, they ought to be explicit and explain their meaning. They make use of contradictory arguments. The Senate represents the states and can alone prevent this dreaded consolidation. Now, that's a huge point that we need to bring back up. Yet the powers of the Senate are objected to. The rights of the people, in my opinion, cannot be affected by the federal courts. I do not know how inferior courts will be regulated. Some suppose that state courts will have this business. Others have imagined that the continent would be divided into a number of districts where courts would be held to as to suits the convenience of the people. Whether this or some other mode will be appointed by Congress, I know not. But this I am sure of, that the state judiciaries are not divested of their present judicial cognizance, and that we have every security that our ease and convenience will be consulted. Unless Congress has this power, their laws could not be carried into execution. So I just check here. Paul, are you back?
Can you hear me, Gio?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah. But you kept on going in and out and going in and out. And so what I wanted to do was finish reading this so that we could kind of take a break. But one of the other things that really jumps out is the Senate represents the states. In other words, it didn't matter who appointed the senators. It doesn't change their obligation in representing the states. And I'm telling you that the current Senate is not representing the states, because they feel like they're obligated to support those who vote for them and paid for their positions. And it doesn't matter. The Constitution is clear that their obligation is to support their state legislatures, whether they appointed them or not. It's right here. It's well defined. So that's my point. When we look at the 17th Amendment, it really didn't pervert the system. It just changed the perception of where the power comes from. So we're into the break right now, Paul. So we'll be right back, folks, after this promo, and we'll try to work out the rest of the audio issues. But anyway, I'm hoping that this really, you know, again, all of this is just This is the national treasure that everybody's been missing. There's no doubt in my mind. We'll be right back after this one promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, folks, we've kind of repaired or fixed or reconnected our comm lines between us and the great state of Missouri. And so now we've got Paul back on. And so, Paul, we kind of just kind of left off with Governor Johnston. And I made the salient point in the body of what he stated as, and this is the highlight here, the Senate represents the states and can alone prevent this dreaded consolidation. Yet the powers of the Senate are objected to.
Okay.
And so, anyway, and that really goes into saying, and you missed this, that when people talk about the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment did not change the state legislature's representation in the Senate. It right. only changed the manner of how they were to be chosen. They're still legally obligated. And the bottom line is the states have a right to petition the Senate to say, look, you're legally obligated to represent us. It doesn't matter how you're chosen and selected. Our suffrage cannot be denied. And basically, this is why, you know, because of what you have done, this only proves that we've lost based on this amendment to the 17th Amendment has taken away our suffrage. We have to undo that.
Correct.
Because bottom line, there's no way they can hold these guys accountable. And they can't, that becomes the underlying thing. But the 17th Amendment had no addressing. It was only changing the manner of how they were to be chosen. It did not change this relationship, or it didn't address it in changing it, which means that it perverted it. Therefore, the 17th Amendment must be actually rescinded. Every state has the opportunity, thanks to Biden and Delaware, they can all rescind the 17th Amendment. Rescind it, not repeal it. Once we right. get down to less than 2 or 3/4 of the states, folks, we only need 7 states to undo the 17th Amendment. 7. I think we can easily get 7 flyover states to stand up and say, this is an abomination. And boom, it's gone.
You know, I think it was pretty sloppily done.
Well, these guys didn't understand the Constitution, and they were bamboozling everybody to say, oh, yeah, you know, in doing this, we can force every state to comply now. They didn't even understand Article 5 and the Amendment Protection Clause.
Right.
Anyway, okay, wow. So Mr. Bloodworth is the next one, and then Mr. J. McDowell, we're kind of in a series here, but I think it's important that we kind of go through this, and it goes for a few pages here, so you're going to see this, but go ahead and bring up Mr.
Okay.
Move forward, yeah. my friend. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just give me some warning when I
okay.
need to stop.
I will try to. Yes, my best.
Mr. Chairman, this is Mr. Bloodworth. Mr. Chairman, the worthy gentleman up last has given me information on a subject which I had never heard before. Hearing so many opinions, I did not know which was right. The honorable gentleman has said that the state courts and the courts of the United States would have concurrent jurisdiction. I beg the committee to reflect what would be the consequence of such measures. it has ever been considered that the trial by jury was one of the greatest rights of the people. I ask whether, if such causes go into the federal court, the trial by jury is not cut off, and whether there is any security that we shall have justice done us. I ask if there be any security that we shall have juries in civil causes. In criminal cases, there are to be juries, but there is no provision made for having civil causes tried by jury. This concurrent jurisdiction is inconsistent with the security of that great right. If it be not, I would wish to hear how it is secured. I have listened with attention to what the learned gentleman has said and have endeavored to see whether their arguments had any weight, but I found none in them. Many words have been spoken and long time taken up, but with me they have gone in at one ear and out at the other. It would give me much pleasure to hear that the trial by jury was secured.
All right.
This is Mr. Yeah.
No, keep going.
Ahead. This is Mr. J. McDowell, trial by jury, and I guess he's an anti-federalist.
Yeah, and so was Bloodworth that you just read. Right. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the objections to this part of the Constitution have not been answered to my satisfaction yet. We know that the trial by jury of the vicinage is one of the greatest securities for property. If causes are to be decided at such a great distance, the poor will be oppressed. In land affairs, particularly the wealthy suitor will prevail. A poor man who has a just claim on a piece of land has not substance to stand it. Can it be supposed that any man of common circumstances can stand the expense and trouble of going from Georgia to Philadelphia, there to have a suit tried? And can it be justly determined without the benefit of a trial by jury? These are things which have justly alarmed the people. What made the people revolt from Great Britain? The trial by jury, that great safeguard of liberty, was taken away, and a stamp duty was laid upon them. This alarmed them and led them to fear that greater oppressions would take place. We then resisted. It involved us in a war and caused us to relinquish a government which made us happy in everything else. The war was very bloody, but we got our independence. We are now giving away our dear bought rights. We ought to consider what we are about to do before we determine. Mr. Spate. Mr. Chairman, the trial by jury was not forgotten in the Constitution. The subject took up a considerable time to investigate it.
Actually,
it was impossible.
Actually, in the convention. Forgotten in the convention.
I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay.
Not forgotten in the convention.
It's important enough for me to correct. So that's okay.
Yeah.
Keep going.
The subject took up a considerable time to investigate it. It was impossible to make any one uniform regulation for all the states or that would include all cases where it would be necessary. It was impossible by one expression to embrace the whole. There are a number of equity and maritime causes in some of the states in which jury trials are not used. Had the convention said that all causes should be tried by jury, equity and maritime cases would have been included. It was therefore left to the legislature to say in what cases it should be used. And as the trial by jury is in full force in the state courts, we have the fullest security.
Okay, so the last full sentence is the kicker. Not just the last portion of that, but I'll read it. It was therefore, he's talking about the convention. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in this new form of government, it was therefore left to the legislature of the state, I'm adding of the state, to say in what cases it should be used. And as the trial by jury is in full force in the state courts, we have the fullest security.
Okay.
So I just wanted to make sure that everybody garners this one point, that it's your state legislatures are supposed to be driving and controlling your courts. And they're not.
Right.
The judiciary has taken over our court system. I mean, this is why we have so many different masters. Go ahead.
Hang on just a minute. Are you saying that the federal jurisdiction hasn't taken over the state court system, has it?
Well, so what type of cases has the federal court system denied over jurisdiction?
Not many.
Actually,
I think if you take some to a federal court, they'll just they'll deal with it.
The only thing that they've been denying is the thing that would actually have changed the political outcome of the 2020 election, which is election fraud and so forth. In other words, they've shut their doors because they knew they actually would open the doors because we actually have the case with the Electoral College. Technically, they're right in their standing, but that's an outlier because every other thing that actually is there's no standing. They shouldn't even have the doors open for Obamacare, all of these abominations that they actually have no jurisdiction. If they were so pure in their intent, they would actually say, we don't have jurisdiction over these things that are not do not arise under this Constitution.
Right.
But they're two-faced. They do everything that creates the advantage for the federal government, which is why every time they open their doors for all of these things that they have no jurisdiction, in essence, those states are surrendering their sovereignty to a court that has no authority.
That is amazing. Okay.
Okay. So now Mr. Iredell is likened in my heart and mind. He's the James Madison of North Carolina.
Okay. Mr. Iredell, amendments and common law. Mr. Chairman, I have waited a considerable time in hopes that some other gentleman would fully discuss this point. I conceive it to be my duty to speak on every subject whereon I think I can throw any light, and it appears to me that some things ought to be said which no gentleman yet has yet mentioned. The gentleman from New Hanover said that our arguments went in at one ear and out the other. This sort of language on so solemn and important an occasion gives me pain. Mr. Bloodworth here declared that he did not mean to convey any disrespectful idea by such an expression, that he did not mean an absolute neglect of their arguments, but that they were not sufficient to convince him that he should be sorry to give pain to any gentleman that he had listened and still would listen with attention to what would be said. Mr. Iredell then continued, I am by no means surprised at the anxiety which is expressed by gentlemen on this subject. Of all the trials that ever were instituted in the world, this, in my opinion, is the best, and that which I hope will continue the longest. If the gentleman who composed the convention had designedly omitted it, no man would be more ready to condemn their conduct than myself. But I have been told that the omission of it arose from the difficulty of establishing one uniform, unexceptionable mode. This mode of trial being different in many particulars in the several states. Gentlemen will be pleased to consider that there is a material difference between an article fixed in the Constitution and a regulation by law. An article in the Constitution, however inconvenient it may prove by experience, can only be altered by altering the Constitution itself, which manifestly is a thing that ought not to be done often. When regulated by law, can easily be occasionally altered so as best to suit the conveniences of the people. Had there been an article in the Constitution taking away that trial, it would justly have excited the public indignation. It was not taken away by the Constitution. Though that does not provide expressly for a trial by jury in civil cases, it does not say that there shall not be such a trial. The reasons of the omission have been mentioned by a member of the late General Convention, Mr. Spade. There are different practices in regard to this trial in different states. In some states, they have no juries in admiralty and equity cases. In others, they have juries in these cases, as well as in suits at common law. I beg leave to say that if any gentleman of ability and knowledge of the subject will only endeavor to fix upon any one rule that would be pleasing to all the states under the impression of their present different habits, he will be convinced that it is impracticable. If the practice of any particular state had been adopted, others, probably, whose practice had been different, would have been discontented. This is the consequence that naturally would have ensued had the provision been made in the Constitution itself. But when the regulation is to be by law, as that law, when found injudicious, can be easily repealed, a majority may be expected to agree upon some method, since some method or other must be first tried, and there is a greater chance of the favorite method of one state being in time preferred. It is not to be presumed that the Congress would dare to deprive the people of this valuable privilege. Their own interest will operate as an additional guard, as none of them could tell how soon they might have occasion for such a trial themselves. The greatest danger from ambition is in criminal cases, but here they have no option. The trial must be by jury in the state wherein the offense is committed, and the writ of habeas corpus will in the meantime secure the citizen against arbitrary imprisonment, which has been the principal source of tyranny in all ages. As to the clause respecting cases arising under the Constitution and the laws of the Union, which the honorable member objected to, it must be observed that laws are useless unless they are executed. At present, Congress have powers which they cannot execute. After making laws which affect the dearest interests of the people in the constitutional mode, they have no way of enforcing them. The situation of those gentlemen who have lately served in Congress must have been very disagreeable. Congress have no power to enter into negotiations with foreign nations, but cannot compel. Oh, Congress have power to enter into negotiations with foreign nations, but cannot compel the observance of treaties that they make. They have been much distressed by their inability to pay the pressing demands of the public creditors. They have been reduced to so low as to borrow principal to pay interest. Such are the unfortunate consequences of this unhappy situation. These are the effects of the pernicious mode of requisitions. Has any state fully paid its quota? I believe not, sir. Yet I am far from thinking that this has been owing altogether to an unwillingness to pay the debts. It may have been in some instances the case, but I believe not in all. Our state legislature has no way of raising any considerable sums but by laying direct taxes. Other states have imports of consequence. These may afford them a considerable relief, but our state perhaps could not have raised its full quota by direct taxes without imposing burdens too heavy for the people to bear. Suppose in this situation Congress had proceeded to enforce their requisitions by sending an army to collect them. What would have been the consequence? Civil war, in which the innocent must have suffered with the guilty. Those who were willing to pay would have been equally distressed with those who were unwilling. Requisitions just having failed of their purpose, it is proposed by this Constitution that instead of collecting taxes by the sword, application shall be made by the government to the individual citizens. If any individual disobeys, the courts have justice can give immediate relief. This is the only natural and effectual method of enforcing laws. As to the danger of concurrent jurisdictions, has any inconvenience resulted from the concurrent jurisdictions in sundry cases of the superior and county courts of this state? The inconvenience of attending at a great distance, which has been so much objected to, is one which would be so general that there is no doubt but that a majority would always feel themselves and their constituents personally interested in preventing it. I have no doubt, therefore, that proper care will be taken to lessen this evil as much as possible, and in particular, that an appeal to the Supreme Court will not be allowed but in cases of great importance where the object may be adequate to the expense. The Supreme Court may possibly be directed to sit alternately in different parts of the Union. That's interesting.
It is, isn't it? As a matter of fact, he really starts stretching this concept of how the court could serve the Union instead of the federal government.
Okay.
And so we've kind of talked about this, and we got 9 minutes, but it's worth bringing up because we've talked about how if we're to have a Republican form of government and that we have this hybrid constitutional republic and a Republican form of government at every level, which means that we should have a representative government. Now, when we look at Congress, Congress actually represents each of the states in some manner and mode, from the people right. to the state government itself. When we look right. at the president is selected by the representative electors across the states, collectively, not by popular vote. So as we look at the, because, I mean, the fact that we have more states than California, I mean, you know, it's been accounted that there could be three or four states with a popular vote that would constantly select the president. And the Electoral College proves that, it actually protects us from that type of tyranny by a basic majority or mob rule.
It certainly should if it's used properly, right?
Right. But in context to the court, who do they represent? Now, we've talked about this, so blank out your mind and biases that I've already polluted the pool of water here and try to be really objective and tell me, when you look at the court, who is it that they're truly representing? When they make law, when they are actually, they can't make law, when they make rulings and they try to create law, and when they, you know, they look at the case law precedents and everything else, who are they really serving? Are they serving the states and the people?
It seems more like they're serving the federal government.
Well, okay, so we see that, but actually, there's even a grander thing, because Sandra Day O'Connor, actually, in a ruling and in the discussion over a very specific case, and I forget exactly what it was, she injected international law. How in the heck can international law be even, you know, mentioned in a court that are, you know, of things that are supposed to arise only under this Constitution?
So I thought that was Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
It may have been Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but I also believe you're right. I think that Sandra O'Connor did that too. But you are right. She did do that. But she's not the only one.
Right. And she bragged about it.
Yes, she did. And, which means she outright violated her oath. And so when they start interpreting, they're violating their oath, because the Constitution did not give them latitude to interpret what they think the Constitution means. They are bound by the terms and definitions of the compact, period, not by the terms and definitions that the justices had created, like John Marshall, but the terms and definitions that were created during the ratification debates, as Madison pointed to. So this is who they serve instead of delaying this. They actually serve the bar and the bar academia in basically trying to broaden the pool of law to encompass all suspect and all potential theories of law, international or not. In other words, they're not disciplined. So when you really look at the court, you know how we say, you know, it'd be great to see, you know, in Congress by like a NASCAR, you see all the sponsors, you know, on their robe or, you know, on the car itself.
Right.
So I think that the same thing ought to be done on the robes of the judges, because don't tell me that Harvard isn't being represented and the Harvard paradigm that they've indoctrinated into this person is not actually what's driving that person. Because they have created this bias and paradigm that has been so prevalent that it's actually become antithetical to the Constitution.
Right.
So how is it that we have representation in the Supreme Court?
I'm not sure we do.
We don't. We really don't, yeah. Folks. Which is why I honestly believe, because they couldn't fathom this then, and they didn't understand, you know, how we would migrate away from truly the Constitution and ensuring states' rights and the rights of the people. Which is why I submit that the Supreme Court, and they should probably jerry it or, you know, fix it so that the term of a justice, 8 years, 6 years, something like that, and that it would be done, the appointment would be by the recommendation of the governor, and that the state legislature would have to basically approve, or the state senate, or what have you. Sure. Actually, it would go to the senate, because that's how it's divided at the federal level, and the separations of power are kind of important. But here's my point. that we should actually have 50 justices and that the justices should actually convene and operate. They do not need to be in chambers, you know, in a physical building. They can be in chambers from their, either their home or from a, you know, a place of office at the state capitol or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I'm just wondering what we would do in the case of a tie.
So in the case of a tie, the president would actually dictate who would be the chief justice, which would be the tiebreaker. And that would be a non-representative of the state. Like, you know, the vice president is the tiebreaker in the Senate. And so okay. If we have an odd number of states, then the president would have the latitude to appoint temporarily, if necessary, a second alternate chief justice that would then, you know, be the other tiebreaker. Because really, when you've only got two votes, you know, for the federal, it doesn't amount to, it's two grains of sand to 50 grains of sand. They really can't right. pollute the water to go one way or the other. The Republic actually has representation in the Supreme Court to ensure that encroachments don't occur. That we, you know, the whole thing moving forward is that the court actually has to prove their jurisdiction that this case arises under the literal Constitution, not some interpretation or some latitude or anything else. And I believe that the state justices that have been appointed for those very specific reasons would guard jurisdiction far more sacred than how we've seen the court quickly with this this elite oligarchy of robes under John Marshall, you know, quickly started assuming roles and responsibilities that they didn't have.
Right.
Just something to chew on, because they're really bringing up some very interesting arguments. I know Virginia did too, but they're really bringing up some really different perspectives. And I think that we've gotten far enough through this to where I honestly think that, you know, the states actually need to sit down and consider, how does the court represent them in our representative government? Even though they are supposed to represent the Constitution, they are not. And it's proven that they're not. They're really representing the growth of academia and the growth of law to international law, which has no business in America.
Wow. Right.
So, you know, this is, I know some people would just think this would be really radical, and it'd be, you know, this would actually alleviate the ability to stack the court. Like FDR and Biden has even threatened to stack the court. The Democrats, they want to do that. They want to have, and this is how they want to have control of the court, so that it's not representative. And
correct.
I see this as, you know, truly a bulwark or a firewall to keep those types of influences from actually entering into our justice system. Because like I said before, we've lost the sight of justice. We're mm-hmm. seeking vengeance, and we're seeking, you know, personal gain instead of justice.
Right.
And so anyway, okay, so we've got 8 seconds. Any parting shots, or we'll talk to you tomorrow?
Let's get together tomorrow. I'm
awesome.
Looking forward to continuing this discussion. Thanks, Jared.
No, thank you for joining us. And folks, we actually ended, I think, in the best case ever of, you know, acknowledging the time and acknowledging the contributions. And so with that, we will be back tomorrow with the North Carolina debates. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.